This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
I've always thought emotion. I never knew there was a category of designing something in motion with specific elements, these elements being letters, words, and titles. When I learned of that little niche in the film business, I realized that I could belong there and I could then apply and execute my ideas in some proper form.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Berman, and in this retrospective edition of In the Studio, I'm talking to Dan Perry, title creator extraordinaire for film and television. Titles are those very first words and images that usher you into the opening of a screen story. Crucial scene setters, often playful clues and hints to let you know what kind of world you're about to spend the next 2 hours or more in. From typewriter keys explosively punching out the opening of All the President's Men, to the creation of Freddy Krueger's monstrous claws in Nightmare on Elm Street, to the legendary opening crawl receding into the galactic distance of Star Wars, Dan Perry has been creating his own mini-movie magic since the early 1970s.
Creating the concept, for me, is a two-step thing. The concept comes first, but then the execution of that idea is called the design. There's many examples of really great concepts that are just mediocre in their execution. Then there are times that the idea is mediocre, but so well executed, it becomes better than it would have been otherwise. But obviously, the best of those worlds would be an amazing idea, so well executed that it's just a classic. And that's what I always strive for. Don't always get there.
Uncredited, Perry designed his first title proper for the legendary Howard Hawks and his western Rio Lobo in 1970. 3 years later, Perry was part of a terrifying movie that still unsettles audiences, William Friedkin's The Exorcist. Perry's blood-red lettering on black alerts you to the seeping evil that you and the characters are about to be plunged into.
Billy always wanted the title to be red, blood red. I did a lot of testing on reds because optical red on film, on black background, it kind of swells and glows. And so the color temperature of that red has to be exactly right so that it doesn't bloom, but still looks red. And then it became the subtleties of combining the titles the right size on the screen, when there's more than one word or name, how the spacing and the proportion and the size of the headings directed by to the name, duration on screen, whether they pop on, fade in, fade out, whatever. All the subtleties that in themselves are not very important, but collectively they make an impact on you. Basically, red titles on black, but to get there was a journey. That's what I usually do. I'd never leave anything unturned or unexplored. I was told from my high school art teacher, the keynote to simplicity is elegance. And with the success of The Exorcist, suddenly I was the flavor of the week and everybody wanted me to do their titles. Pretty much it's been that way ever since.
Blockbusters, comedies and intimate dramas from some of the greatest directors of the last 40 years. Anything from Oliver Stone's greedy epic Wall Street to pretty much every great Martin Scorsese film to the cosmic magic of Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Much more of which later. But for Perry and anyone else creating titles, there is only one person to begin the creative conversation with.
In the feature world, it's the director who's in charge. Along the way, I might interface with the production designer, with the cameraman. He might shoot something for me if I design a sequence, and certainly with the whole editorial department. Oftentimes, in fact, all the time, if I can control it, we're working collaboratively with the composer, because the music often drives what I'm doing. And so I need to know what the composer's doing. And conversely, he needs to know what I'm doing visually so he can write something to that. So we have a marriage of music and picture. Other times, there might not be any music until they had a preview, maybe, and we realized, wow, we need to have a cue there, you know. There have been instances where I didn't have the luxury of working against the music.
There you are. You're working on these intense, you know, 30 seconds to 2.5 minutes, tiny mini movies. Which director have you most found a reciprocal way of talking about what you're watching, what you're experiencing?
Well, I would have to say Scorsese, having done 10 films with him. If you look back on his films, the ones I did with him were some of his best work. And that doesn't mean to say that it's because of my titles, but he was really at his peak.
What kind of dialogue would you have together? Because presumably you worked out a shorthand pretty quick. I mean, it's not exactly the slowest talker in the world anyway.
No, I talk fast as well, so I could keep up with him. It seemed to always be a quite simple process. We'd see his film, and it would always be with him. You know, I'd be sitting with him, viewing it, rather than he's sending it to me. On Taxi Driver, for example, I created a whole sequence with temp music that Marty had chosen while editing. On the side, he's having Bernard Herrmann write the score at the last minute, and Herrmann finished it like a week before he died. And only when I finished shooting it on film and brought it to Marty, and at that point he was on the recording stage doing the mix, you know, marrying the sound with the picture. And I remember coming in, it was at Columbia, and I was sent up to the projection booth upstairs to deliver the print that I brought with me, and they cut it into the head of Reel One. And then as I came down the stairs, it had already gone dark, and the Columbia logo came up. So we viewed the sequence with the music for the first time. They shut down at the end of the title sequence, and the lights came up, and Marty comes rushing up to me across the room and congratulated me and said how great it looked and so on. And then he said, say hi to Bernard Herrmann. So I looked to my right, and there was this little natty man standing there who was grinning and was so delighted with how his music looked with my picture. And we had a moment where we congratulated each other. It was really, really very special.
I mean, it's a terrifying film from first shot, from your titles, yeah. In fact. The best non-shark film, if you see what I mean. I mean, the way that cab emerges with that terrifying Herrmann music, which you didn't have, it's a predatory machine in an infernal night. What was Scorsese's conversation with you before you go off and do it? What did you have to draw upon, both in terms of material from the film, but also, yeah, up there in your noggin?
The first step for me was to view over 200,000 feet of second unit shot by the production designer, David Snyder, all over New York City. So I sat with editor Marcia Lucas, at that time George Lucas's wife, and we viewed all this footage over several days, and I made selections and finally assembled a cut of the sequence that became the title sequence. And then I had very strong ideas about the titles themselves and how they would integrate with the footage, and then treating the footage in this kind of scary underground kind of feeling to illustrate both the environment that Travis Bickle lived in and the horror and the fear and the obsession and all of those feelings that he was having, including paranoia. So to affect the footage in such a way that it would convey those feelings, hopefully, to the viewer. Duplicating a shot by copying it once, then you wind back and copy it again, but you slip it one frame, and then wind back and copy it again, slip it one more frame. So you could slip it as many frames as you wanted. The image would follow itself like a streaking, trailing effect. And that's what I used for the one-shot POV looking through the windshield, which is in slow motion as well. I slowed it down so that it had this ethereal, frightening kind of looming fear feeling to it.
It sort of slips over like disappearing light as well, isn't it? It's like the reflections from the street.
That's right. It had the effect of it reflecting the glow of the rain on the windshield or on the street and the light bouncing off the street. Titles themselves, I always wanted them to be like the street signs at the top of the posts on the corners in New York City. So what better way to do them than to reproduce them exactly as they were. So I went to the New York City Traffic Department and got the font that they were using for all their signs, the ones that were on the little horizontal metal signs that were stamped on was the style I wanted to use. And further, I wanted to duplicate exactly the way they crowded the lines together and packed the letters together, because the signs were always the same size. Some long street name, they had to pack it in. And if it was a short street name, they could spread it out a little. So I took that type style and wanted the compression that came out of the tension of jamming letters together and then stacking them up and arranging them either flush right or flush left, depending upon the side of the sign that the words appeared, and then place them high in the frame whenever possible, but always to one side or the other. And then when superimposing them over the shots, I purposely didn't carry a mat to where the titles were protected as they were exposed. Without a mat, the shot was contaminating the title. And the glow of the smoke, it was irregular and unpredictable, and it really worked to extend those feelings that I wanted to enhance. Altogether, it worked like gangbusters.
These are all the movie brats, right? These are all the kids on the block who are going to become the huge directors. So De Palma, Scorsese, Spielberg, Lucas, pretty much everyone.
Literally shared by them. There were times I'd go to meet with Scorsese on the mixing stage. And I remember a day when I walked in, they were all there, you know, just hanging out together. Often had ping pong tables when they were shut down, were putting a new reel up or something. They'd go and play ping pong. John Milius was one of the team. He smoked these big fat cigars. So when he was there, they'd be all smoking cigars. That handful of young directors supported each other in their adventures. And they all valued what titles could do to their films.
Tell me about Star Wars, which Lucas had, I think, from the early script, had a crawl in mind. But what was the brief for Star Wars, and what did you want to bring to it?
Well, I'm not sure he knew. He maybe might have known in his head, but I don't think he ever conveyed that to me clearly enough.
Obviously, Lucas had been inspired by Flash Gordon, and Flash Gordon does have a crawl.
Yeah, he asked me to look at all those Flash Gordon films and Buck Rogers films and so on. As I started viewing things, I'd sometimes go to his place out in Van Nuys, which is like 20 miles from here, trek out there and with a 60 million print and a little screening room, I'd view things there. Other times they'd arrange for me to see some Warner Brothers film or some Fox films. And finally, Cecil B. DeMille film is about the railroad, Union Pacific. And the first shot is looking down the tracks, you know, empty railroad tracks, as far as you can see. And under the camera, titles roll down the tracks as a crawl. And they were hand-painted on glass, and they were shot in motion like that way. So I envisioned that in space. So then how would that look? What type style would it be? Would it be futuristic? Would the angle of the title so you could read them? How long should it run for? And all of that, I brought it to George, and he loved the idea. So that started months of testing and shooting. First, he gave me the wording on the preamble. So I set that in 4, 5, 6, 8 different type styles and showed them all to him. And we finally settled on a type style. It was in the Futura line. So now how many words per line will it be if you do 6 words per line? And he did testing and testing and shooting and setting type over and over and over. And finally, when we got that resolved, the line breaks that had to be flush right and left. So there were different amounts of spacing between words so that they filled the same line by line. So then we started shooting tests on the tilt. What perspective angle would it be? Where would the horizon line be? Above center or below? Or above center was better because it was more tilted straight up so you could read it for a longer period of time. If it was tilted so far that it went to a horizon line below center, then you couldn't read it for very long before it just blocked up into a blob of letters. So all that testing, day by day, I shoot something on the animation stand, and then we rigged a special camera that was on wheels, but it was on tracks. I would move toward the artwork rather than, you know, I would move the artwork. It was so big, and I had all the words pasted onto it, and shooting high contrast, the paper that each word was pasted onto, it would curl up from the heat of the light, and then the edge of the paper would be white, so I had to black the edges, and it was a huge mess. And every time I changed the slightest thing, I had to rebuild the whole thing and then shoot it again. And then the next day, we'd get it from the lab. I drive out to Van Nuys, and I'd wait 2 hours to show it to George, and he wouldn't like it. This went on and on and on and on. Then I saw that as it went back into space, the lines that followed started obliterating the line ahead of it. So I then started proportionally spacing the lines so as to allow for more reading time before it became a blob of unreadable letters. Finally, I had all the things solved and resolved, and it was ready to go. And George gave me an IP of the background star field. I then superimposed it with my optical people and put it together.
And what were the color choices available to you with obviously a black or deep velvet colored star filled?
Well, I tested white, yellow, blue, pink. We wound up with yellow. I preferred white myself, but we hardly ever agreed on anything, so it didn't matter at that point. By that time, I just hated having to go out there and wait for him. He was very sullen. He never praised it or thanks a lot, you know, good job, that sort of thing. I knew the pressure he was under, and I experienced that with other films where the director is just with his back to the wall, and Fox was on the fence with it, and they had invested so much already. The day I delivered it, it was like a huge weight lifted off of my shoulders. Jimmy Nelson, who was the post-supervisor, called me, and he said, George asked me to ask you and a couple of other key people in post if you'd be willing to take half a point on the film instead of your fee. And I like instantaneously said, no, are you kidding me? No way. This was this stupid space film that wasn't going to go anywhere. You know, no one's ever going to see it. And whoever did see it were kids. You know, I didn't care about it. I didn't think anything of it. So I turned it down. It's really amazing the reaction that people have to it. And it still continues. Generation after generation still appreciates it.
Let me take you back as a kid. What sense did you have of how titles even worked on you?
When I was a kid, I had no sense of that. Never had any consciousness or awareness of titles until I was doing graphic design. A good friend of mine from high school, we were fellow art students. He was working at an optical effects company preparing artwork for titles. He wasn't designing them, but designers of the day were coming in with their work, and he was preparing the work to be shot on the film. And it was something, wow, I didn't know that, you know, people did that. And then he was doing a freelance job. He was building these three-dimensional letters in a TV commercial, and he couldn't finish the job, and so he gave me the job. So I went over to this studio where they were filming these letters, and on the walls of their offices were these storyboards that illustrated how a title design might occur. And I made note of the designer's name on them, and I went to see him, and he wound up hiring me and exploiting me for a couple of years while he was doing major studio titles for Paramount and Fox and so on.
This is In the Studio, the BBC World Service documentary.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are exposed. And in this new series, we investigate the dark side of the wellness industry, following the story of a woman who joined a yoga school only to uncover a world she never expected.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this.
Where the hope of spiritual breakthroughs leaves people vulnerable to exploitation.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
World of Secrets, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
There was only one true king of movie titles from the 1950s onwards, Saul Bass, or rather Saul Bass and his team, the graphic design wizard behind iconic logos of American corporate giants and scintillating title sequences for Stanley Kubrick, Billy Wilder, and of course, Alfred Hitchcock.
Saul was my mentor. I learned of Saul first in high school. I was very fortunate that my high school art teacher had been an agency art director on Madison Avenue in New York at one of the big ad agencies. And I became her favorite student. And she imparted on me and all my colleagues all of her knowledge and experience about advertising. And I wanted to be an agency art director. She exposed us to all of the design manuals that were available then. So I studied them. They became my Bibles. They would show different designers and art directors' work. And one that was in all of them was Saul Bass's work. And I loved what he did. There might have been a storyboard here and there, but I wasn't aware of his title work. I was aware of his graphic work, to where I wanted to be like him. And I started designing like him, had the same sense of imagery and contrast and graphics and bold images. By my senior year, I learned quite by accident that Saul's studio was right there in L.A. on Sunset Boulevard. I was driving by then. I had my own car. So I drove over to his studio, just imagining that I would meet him and show him my high school work. I went in and asked to see him, and I had no appointment, so they'd asked me to wait. Didn't even know what he looked like, really, at that point. Finally, after coming three or four or five times, he came by, and the secretary said, "Saul, this is Dan Perry. He's been waiting to see you." And so he invited me into his office, and he looked through my work, and he saw I had promised. Saul said, "Well, I'll keep track of you. I want you to come and see me every month or so." And so he started mentoring me and recommending me and advising me and guiding me. And finally, I went into the Navy, because I was going to be drafted otherwise. And I did a lot of graphic design work. And then after 2 years, I came out of the Navy and I went directly to Saul. And at that time, he had just designed the Bell Telephone logo, which now had to be applied to hundreds of different things, you know, on the cap and on the truck and on their forms and so on. I mean, he was hiring three designers just to design all the Bell Telephone collateral material. He gave me a contract to sign. Within it said that anything I would design, whether it would be on Saturday morning at home or in his office or for a project I might have independently, he owned it and he claimed credit for it. And I just didn't like the idea of that. I'd never heard of that, which of course is how he operated. He had a staff of designers and everything they did, he did. And I said to myself, if Saul Bass wants me, I must be good enough. So I turned the job down. I opened my own little studio. And eventually, when I started doing titles, I would run into Saul at the cattle calls that they would have where they'd invite three or four designers in who would all then offer ideas for the titles. We always had a wonderful regard for each other. He was very kind and generous to me and was happy to see how I was progressing. And we remained in touch through the rest of his life. Finally, after I did 8 films with Scorsese, Marty got really famous and he decided that he wanted Saul to do his titles. So Saul started doing his work. And then Saul would call me and invite me to lunch at his studio. And we talk all about Scorsese. So Saul did 5 films with Marty and I consulted with him on every one of them. So I kind of went the circle.
Titles in a way are, they're an invitation to the audience to get with the mood of the film. So yeah. What was the first title sequence you did where you could do something like that, where you could say to the audience, aha?
I think it was probably Nashville, which was 1975. And by that time, I was working with Bob Altman. I had done his previous film, California Split. And after that, he asked me to move into his building. And I then became his creative consultant on all of his films. He'd always call me in to be in the meetings with his writers and cameraman and so on as he was developing a film. So on Nashville, I'd gone to a very prestigious, expensive art school, and I was taught how to design really beautiful, elegant graphics that were handsome and powerful and rich and so on. So I came to Bob with a dozen different ideas that were very elegant and beautiful and handsome and expensive and rich. And he looked at all of them. He said, "They're all wrong. This isn't my film. This isn't Nashville." He said, "Look at the film." So as I viewed the first cut, which at that time was very long, when I saw how Nashville was this junky, trashy, dirty place where there was all these scroungy people trying to get a chance to do their music and all, I noticed on late night television were these junky, cheap commercials where they were selling music that had been re-recorded from, you know, pop stuff or country western, or and they were jamming all these songs into one album and sell them for like $3 or $4. But these late night TV commercials were yelling and screaming at you, trying to sell you these albums. They're just talking a mile a minute, and all these images were flashing on and zooming through and so on. It was done just so cheaply and so poorly, but I thought, that's what we need for the title sequence. So I wrote a script. It was exactly 60 seconds, the amount of time you'd buy on television at that time for a commercial. And I found the guy who did those commercials and hired him. Johnny Grant was his name. By that time, Bob had had an illustrator do a painting that became the cover for the record album. So I took that and I shot it on the camera stand. And as the narrator is yelling and starring Ned Beatty and Keith Carradine, and we zoom into that person's face on the painting, which had all of them jammed into the album cover. At the same time, there was a roll-up going up with the name of the songs and another roll-up going down and things fanning through the frame, and it was all this piles of junk. And he just loved it. Just worked like gangbusters. And he had a soundtrack thrown on it that was overlapping different songs, different sounds, and so all at the same time. When that ended, it segued into the first shot of the film, a garage door going up, and on the door it says Nashville and some other words, and then the truck pulls out this selling the candidate that is the character in the story. And there's about 20 titles that are laid over the action very quietly in red, white, and blue. That comprised the whole title sequence. But Paramount liked the title sequence of the record album so much that they used it as the trailer as well. And I'm still really proud of that, too. It just worked perfectly.
From the promised land of Nashville to an entirely more cosmic destination, Steven Spielberg's epic of obsession, belief, and aliens in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where Perry became a brand designer to the stars.
Good morning, and are you still seeing those lights that you were reporting earlier?
Spielberg had the wisdom to realize the value of having a logo established as soon as possible. So before production began, he asked me to do the titles. The logo comes out of an existing type style called Handel, which I drew from and then put the lines in it, the horizontal parallel lines. But it worked very well on screen because it was a nice, thick, fully developed graphic Gothic style. But it had unique shapes to it, curves and things that made it kind of space-oriented, mysterious and unknown. So we did a logo, and then all correspondence then was done by letter. So we did this beautiful engraved embossed stationery. We did a T-shirt, so all the crew and everyone wore the T-shirts, and on the back it said CE3K, which was the abbreviated title. But it served to bond everyone because there was a consistent image that everyone worked under and knew about. And then when Spielberg had got back from location, he asked me to do all the interstitial titles, identifying the locale or the date or whatever it was during the film. And then, of course, the end titles and the remainder of the main titles. Then he asked me to do the ad campaign. He said, I made an appointment for you with Bob Cort, the head of advertising. Go over and talk to him. So I go to see Bob Cort. He was commanded to hire me, but I didn't know that. So I come in his office and there's this stack of styrofoam equivalent of a full newspaper page of an ad. And he had hired every major and minor design studio in New York and L.A. And they all had submitted these ideas. But Spielberg had rejected all of them. Talk to Dan Perry. He's doing my titles. I want him to do the ad. So now Bob Cort is talking to me and he's walking around me like I'm being interrogated. He's got a rubber band that he's pulling between hands and it's snapping and all. How much do you want for this? I hadn't thought about it. I think I hadn't done an ad campaign before that time. And I didn't know what they're worth. So I was thinking, I don't know, 3,000, maybe 5,000. So before I was about to say 5,000, he said, oh, look, I'll give you 10 grand. Okay. So I did the whole ad campaign, all the different size newspaper ads, the poster, the billboard, the game box, the novel, everything.
For the listener, as it were, this being radio, give me the radio picture of it because it's utterly iconic. But for someone who's never seen what this is, in a sense, a piece of mysterious minimalism that is both a road vanishing into unspecified light, but it also begins to feel like you're on some kind of mystical path. There's almost a 2001 feel to it because the way the white lines converge, you've got a sense of speed, progress, and mysterious journey.
It became known as the road and the glow. And it was done by an airbrush artist that I had used many times, Charlie Wild. I settled on the road and the glow, and then I enhanced it, created more of a glow coming from behind the hill. There was a certain amount of stars that were initially there, but added more to fill it in and give it more of an aesthetic appeal. And then I applied the logo to it at the bottom in two lines. The words of the third kind are secondary to their adjective to what kind of close encounter is it, the third kind. And then up in space are the three kinds of encounters that a person would have with an alien. So all of that had to be kind of explained. And the way I designed it, where they're diminishing size for each of those words and lines and change color so that it emphasized each separately. Collectively, you get an impression of this movie before you can see it. And where it's going, you don't know. So the glow is suggesting something perhaps fearful or frightening, or the intrigue that was created and the buildup and the mystery and the sense of dread and fear were so powerfully apparent. And it just worked so well. It was a classic example of just the right combination of everything. That's the job of a poster.
We must maintain the integrity of the White House. And that integrity must be real, not transparent. There can be no whitewash at the White House.
Close Encounters features plenty of paranoia and shady government agencies. But for the ultimate American political expose, look no further than Watergate and President Richard Nixon's humiliating fall from office, helped in no small measure by Woodward and Bernstein's investigative exposés for the Washington Post, a paper then busy illuminating the darkness, all captured perfectly by director Alan J. Pakula in 1976 with All the President's Men. No guessing who did the titles.
At the White House.
Working with Pakula, he was a very precise man, very creative, like quiet and sensitive. Didn't share his ideas easily. You had to pry it out of him. But once again, I wanted something that was extremely simple and that there would be details over backgrounds and had to be very quiet. There was this break-in going on that was very suspicious and dark and unknown. So people were they were breaking into a building and carefully, quietly stealing things. So the titles had to be in that same world. So they were in extremely thin Helvetica, all caps and lowercase. And they were lived all in the corner of the frame and they had to be small and quiet, almost not there. So it was all on film. Everything was done in feet. The titles I lived on the screen for about 8 seconds. So I tested wanting them to fade in 4 seconds and fade out immediately in 4 seconds. So they were never on the frame full 100%. They were always either fading in or fading out. So they were like whispers of smoke. And they were so quiet. And I made them dark gray. So as they came in, they're barely there, but there was enough time to read them and they fade out. And it just looked so impeccable. It was just so elegant and quiet and simple. Alan loved it.
That's the shot at the beginning, the massive close-up on the typewriter.
He shot that, but it was an idea that we'd come to together, the notion of something to jar the audience. But there had to be something ahead of that in order that there'd be full impact on that shot. So the way it happened was the Warner Brothers logo would come in, zoom up, fade to black, and then cut to white was finally what we wound up doing. But I wanted something that would settle the audience down to where by the time the first key hit, it would scare them. I suggested that we do a little Bugs Bunny cartoon, but we wound up just putting a long length of white in, which was the paper before the key hit. Sit there and watch and watch. And then suddenly you go, what the hell is this? Then bam!
Well, it's still explosive. I mean, there's a writer called Isaac Babel. I don't know if you know his work. He was a fabulous Russian writer, but he had a saying that a full stop could be as powerful as an iron spike. The word is the weapon,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. And then he returns to that for the end of the film, which is all about the Washington Post and the writers and Nixon resigning and so on. So at the end of the film, I suggested that we do all the headlines of all the days that the Washington Post was publishing, and as each successive story came out and what that did to the public and to the journalistic world and so on. Alan liked the idea. I had to fly to Washington, D.C. This was on Christmas Eve. The Library of Congress was opened up for me on Christmas Day. I hired a local photographer and we shot 4x5 still frames of each headline that we laid on the floor, on this cold stone floor in the Library of Congress on Christmas Day. And I shot all these shots of the headlines. And I spent the night at the Watergate Hotel. Next morning, I flew back to L.A. By then, it was a weekday. And I took the 4x5s to the lab, had them developed and printed. And then I shot them on the camera stand and made a sequence out of these headlines. This was an afterthought. So the end titles were already done weeks before. So about a month later, I was invited to the cast crew screening. And the film was wonderful. And I was very proud of having done the main titles, and the story was so powerful. And so now the film ends and what comes up on the screen, and I'm anticipating this sequence of headlines, what comes up on the screen is a tight shot of the teletype machine, which types out the headlines that became newspaper. Alan had thrown out the whole sequence that I spent all this time going to Washington and everything else, and he didn't even use it. You're vulnerable. You're there offering your ideas. You know, you're exposing yourself to ridicule and criticism. You're giving it yourself from the inside. You know, you're vulnerable, but you believe this is a good idea and it's beneficial for the film, so you offer it.
Perfection is mostly a chimera in filmmaking, especially with something as last minute as the titles. But celebrated auteur Terrence Malick gave Perry free rein in his ravishing 1978 film, Days of Heaven. It's a tale full of melancholy, doomed love captured in golden hues, plus an unforgettable plague of locusts. Perry created a hypnotic title sequence in black and white, full of fragile, staring faces, harsh realities and longing looks from turn-of-a-century American photography, all to the accompaniment of Camille Saint-Saëns' magical aquarium movement from his Carnival of Animals. The impact is both seductive and unforgettable.
I really saw a lot of similarities between Terry and I, how we thought and appreciation for the smallest details and the gentleness of patience and allowing something to live on its own and grow naturally. So all those images, gathering them, and then how to present them. Of course, I had him to refer to, and I had his film to refer to gather and to glean those notions and those rhythms and beats. Once I get in close to the director and in their head, I just let things come out of me. None of that is intellectualized. It comes by itself. That's how it happens.
You watch presumably what, the rough cut of Days of Heaven, which is, right, you know, past. It's already over before it's begun in a way, and your title sequence. Yeah, it's incredibly artful. Where did you look for the images first?
There were a number of research libraries. They would send me groups of photos. Then it was faxes, but it gave me enough of a sense of the picture that I would then ask for high quality 8x10. So I would then, you know, lay them on the floor and imagine moving from this one and pull out of here and then go across that one and so on. And then I'd bring it all to Terry and we'd lay it on the floor and look at it. And he always loved what he was seeing because it was so connected to his film. You know, they're so right for it. Then it was a matter of just figuring out the best order and the best number of shots and how long we would dwell on them, how to accommodate the titles, which at that point we already had a list of the credits from the producers. But because of Terry's his inability to make a decision, which he's famous for, we would come to an agreement on the order. So I then would go away and shoot them on the camera stand. So I'd bring it to him a couple of days later. We'd view it. He loved it. But then he wanted, but I want this picture earlier now. So we'd lay him on the floor again. And we had a stack of others that we had eliminated. Then we'd go back into that stack and find a couple more they wanted to add or maybe replace. And then I'd go away and shoot it again. This went on for a couple of months, at least every few days. But it was fun, always creative. And so we finally came to the sequence that he was happiest with. All along the way, I kept asking, what about music, Terry? I mean, I'm so motivated by music and I can make it better by marrying it more closely to the emotional beats of the music. And he had various things he was choosing. And when he found something he liked, he'd give it to me. And I'd work against it and play it and listen to it and react to it. But he, of course, changed that many times as well. So it was only after he had approved the background sequence and I was now into the phase of designing the titles, finding the correct type, that he gave me the Carnival of the Animals, the Saint-Saëns. So it all came together very nicely, but very slowly. The rhythms were just longer than normal, but the elements and the beats and the rhythms of the process were the same. It was just elongated because of Terry's process. The sequence is always in motion. We're always exploring each shot. And then there's an inner rhythm where there's a wide shot that we move on and often off-center move to move into something or pull out of something. And those wide shots contain the titles, one title per shot. And then we would dissolve to a close-up and see these beautiful faces of these people. And there were no titles on any of those. So if we had 16 titles, for example, we had to have 16 wide shots to accommodate each of those titles. And then one close-up in between each of those. So that was the goal. I had structured it so that it had to be that combination of shots and moves and so on.
Title design has to serve the master narrative, but there is obviously pride, delight, and a great deal of art and artifice that goes into them. So do you always conceive each of these as a mini production?
Well, they become that way sometimes, but I always see them as a part of the film and part of the influence that the storytelling can bring to a viewer. Though sometimes the sequence might be unto itself. It'll have a beginning and an end, and it'll fade out, and then the film starts sometimes. But in those cases, I still feel it's part of the storytelling. Its intentions are to establish the milieu, the era, the date, the characters, attitude, so that the story can be told that follows more effectively. I never see them as being the star, even for those few minutes. The titles can do all of these things that I mentioned and only incidentally introduce the titles.
You've been listening to title designer Dan Perry, revealing his secrets to me, Mark Berman, for In the Studio. You can download many more explorations of creative brilliance from the BBC World Service documentary website.
Hello, I'm Katia Adler, host of the Global Story podcast from the BBC. Each weekday, we break down one big news story with fresh perspectives from journalists around the world. From artificial intelligence to divisive politics tearing our societies apart. From the movements of money and markets to the human stories that touch our lives. We bring you in-depth insights from across the BBC and beyond. Listen to the Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.